Welcome to the Angle Podcast. This is where we explore African perspectives on creative industry, that's gaming, VR, AR, animation, and we also take deep dives into tech startups and digital governance.
So he hasn't learned a strapline yet. It's actually African perspectives on digital culture, creativity, media, money, and governance.
Oh, that's right? Lovely.
Stopping by for a chat today, Kavusha Pile.
Hi.
Thanks for coming through.
It's a pleasure to be here.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
How's the Joburg weather for you?
You know, it's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah, I'm this type of girl. I like the rainy, cozy weather.
I'm freezing.
The heat was becoming a bit too intense.
Ah, yeah, that heat.
So I'm happy else. For reprieves of nice cold weather.
Nice.
Just as a matter of intro, maybe just give us a quick breakdown of who you are professionally.
Just professionally?
So I'm a social justice activist. It's hard to say that. It's hard to say that that you're an activist professionally when it's your personal politics in life. Anyways, for the purposes of this
personal
discussion, I've worked in the human rights space for all of my career. Started off at a local organization called Corruption Watch and managed campaigns, built civic tech there, dealt with whistleblower complaints and so on. And then about a year ago, I started up my own human rights organization called the Campaign on Digital Ethics, or CODE. And here we're looking at the intersection between technology, democracy, and human rights. So having, you know, a focus area on the influence of big tech on society, on our politics, on our economy, and trying to find ways to ensure that technologies that we build are aligned with human rights principles, and that they actually enable and support democracies as opposed to eroding them.
How do you actually do that? How do you actually start up an organization? Just create a website and say, we are now an organization? I mean, I presume there's some paperwork involved, but how does that work exactly?
Yeah, no, it's actually, it's quite a mission. And I'm still, I think, in that startup phase. So it's about, you know, if you're running a sort of human rights organizations, chances are it's a nonprofit.
Yeah.
So, you know, it means getting funding, meeting with donors and philanthropic organizations, trying to convince them that this is a key issue that they need to be focusing on and investing in. It's about getting a board in place and making sure that your board is, you know, steering the organization in very strategic ways.
Right.
It's about building credibility with other civil society organizations, introducing yourself to communities and to the world, and basically saying that this is an issue that we should be focusing on. So in the same way that, you know, there's been so much of mobilization around issues related to climate change or healthcare or education, and amazing activism going on there, it's about trying to create a bit of action and getting people engaged in the information integrity ecosystem and starting to understand how we're consuming information, how that information is influencing how we behave, how we vote, the types of technologies that are driving certain behaviors, and seeing that, you know, all of this is quite interconnected. So it's not something that operates separately outside of a, you know, health space or education space, especially in this time, you know, in South Africa, where there's so much of contention around the NHI, for example, or the recent Bella Bill. And a lot of this, you know, the upset that's been, coming from the public, a lot of it is, you know, disinformation and misunderstanding. We're seeing this with the Land Expropriation Bill as well, that's causing polarization. And we're, you know, sort of moving away from fundamental principles about the right to basic health care or the right to quality education. And it seems that we, you know, sort of consume reactionary bits of information that then drive us further and further apart from the designers of our constitution of, you know, creating an equal and just and fair society. So it's a pretty big job, and we're still in our early startup phases. But it's very exciting just because, you know, no day looks the same. Every day it's something or other that's
there's
happening.
Something up in the news.
So just another quick question related to that. I mean, so I come from obviously more commercial background working from media, but, you know, I'm starting to explore the funded space and the sort of the space of this, almost the space of ideas almost in terms and their application, I would say. You know, when you're approaching funders like that and you're doing your rounds and you're meeting with people and you're trying to get people to give you money, how do you sell them an outcome? Like they say, okay, they obviously... The first step, they somewhat need to believe in yourself and what you're aiming to do and what you stand for. But in terms of investment, is that just by association that gives them value? Or how does that, like, what's the sell point for an organization to give you money?
I mean, it's a tricky one because, you know, I think on the one hand, funders are looking for people of credibility and integrity because it is quite a loose space.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of investment of money into ideas that may or may not work. So they want to also sort of make sure that at least you've tried and it's you're not going to report back with, you know, shallow outcomes like, oh, we got X amount of media hits. You know, that may be important in some cases, but, you know, especially at this time where I think we are in quite a critical and tough time in the world, you want to be able to see that this has had some sort of tangible impact.
Yeah.
So I think it's about, you know, being able to show that, you know, that there may be some direct outcomes of this. So if I have to just go back to Code's work, is that, you know, if I want to say a lot of my work is about big tech accountability, but there's no guarantee there. So there's no guarantee that we would ever be able to hold Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg or any of these, you know, or and their platforms accountable just because there's a lack of regulations and laws. But I can say we're doing digital literacy training with people because in the absence of trying to get the platforms right, at least if we show people how to navigate these the platforms safely and how to understand algorithms and how to spot deep fakes, you're then providing people with something tangible that would potentially make them safer in online spaces, but also perhaps lead to more responsible consumption of information, more responsible online behavior. So it's important to have the big ideas and to pursue those big ideas, but then it's also important to have the programs that you know are going to, that will shift the dial in some way.
I suppose ultimately you do want to somehow influence policy and laws down the line.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if you're doing this type of work around advocacy is about trying to ensure that governments will come up with progressive legislation and rules and laws that would, you know, make sure that their safety and that people are safe and so on. So you can, I mean, that should always be a goal, you know, a long-term goal is to be able to shape something in a policy environment. But because that work doesn't happen overnight, you know, you have to have things, your stepping stones.
Good thing you started young.
What was that point in South Africa for you that you went, okay, I think there's need for advocacy like this?
So this is quite funny and potentially controversial to a few people, but it was the 10 babies story.
Yes, the Tembisa 10.
Yes, the Tembisa 10. I mean, that was a big turning point for me.
Okay.
Just because, I mean, obviously there was a ton of other things that was happening, right. COVID, conspiracies, vaccines, you know, 5G, all of that stuff. But the Tembisa 10 story was just, it was, you know, it was
that's
something weird. It was like this weird story. Like, and exactly. I hope somebody writes, you know, a really good book about this.
There's a book about the Tembisa 10.
There's a book to be written about this because there was it was so much more deeper than here's a story about 10 babies. It like played into the sort of psychology about who do we trust in the media and who don't we trust. And, you know, let's sort of talk about the factions. You know, it's this group versus that group, and this group of people who consume this type of information versus that group of people who consume that type of information. And I mean, there's still people out there who legitimately believe that these babies were born, but then they were sort of stolen by some foreign national doctor. So then the xenophobia comes in,
right.
and the sort of fear mongering. And that was my turning point, because I think it's been bubbling up for some time about, about just the sort of conspiracy theories and how it can play into our thinking. But I always often thought of it as like a fringe thing that happened in dark spaces of the internet.
Right.
But here was a story that, you know, became so mainstream, was reported all around the world, and then all of a sudden, just like slowly, it started to piece away. And I had crazy arguments with close friends of mine,
right,
who just genuinely believed that the story was true and everybody was just out to get the journalist, and that it was just an attempt to discredit the journalist. And I mean, if the story was true, I think the Tembisa 10 would have been starting school this year.
They would be old enough.
But yeah, they'd be old enough to be starting school. But it was in that moment that I started to see there's some fundamental shifts that are going on. And, you know, I was working in the anti-corruption space and had encountered the Bell Pottinger issue. And I remember prior to Bell Pottinger, it was quite easy to talk to people about corruption, in that, you know, it was a matter of right and wrong.
Right.
And that anybody who is stealing public money and public funds should be held accountable.
Yeah.
What Bell Pottinger did, and the sort of the influencers and so on, was the sort of narrative change around white monopoly capital, radical economic transformation. All of those things are important. I think it was good that we start to have those conversations about economic inequality in the country. But what it did was that it so fundamentally shifted and polarized the conversation that you could no longer talk about corruption without it becoming a racialized issue.
Right.
You know? And whilst it's important to deal with inequalities, I think it shifted us away from trying to call for accountability, because it was like, well, it became an us versus them. It was a polarization thing that happened.
Yeah.
And I think that those types of behaviors and narratives have just continued to seep into our society, where it's no longer on any issue.
Right.
It's very rarely that you're going to find the vast majority of people agreeing on it, because there's so many now. There's such different sides. And I think that polarization effort, you know, has worked.
But, you know, the Bell Pottinger thing, I think there was a bit of truth attached to it, because it was addressing issues.
Yeah.
Right? So I understand how it got the media attention, and it was that big. The Tembisa 10, how the hell did it make it to mainstream media with no credibility?
It's a perfect news story.
Yeah.
So it was just out to get it.
No, it was a world record, but they had a scoop. It was the Sunday World, right? Oh, it was one of the publications of the Independent had this scoop about this world record of 10 babies being born. And
without
it's a weird
verification. They didn't verify that stuff. They just went out, 10 babies out.
It was just a football stunt. And
that's why I think that there's a story in this, and that's why I think that there's a book in this, because there's a part of me that wonders whether or not it was actually just a really interesting social experiment to see where people actually stand around media trust and credibility, and who's reading what and who's consuming what, and to what extent will people believe a blatant lie. Mm. And if it was a social experiment, I think it was a perfect one. Because it basically sort of laid the sort of floor plan of how you can target particular types of people with particular types of messaging in a mainstream way. Because on social media, you know, all of these experiments have been happening for a while. So Cambridge Analytica and so on, you know, let's hit you with things that will make you fearful. So that's why you're seeing a rise in, you know, xenophobic rhetoric and, you know, anti-immigrant behavior and so on. But here was a different type of experiment of let's go into a mainstream media publication and let the whole world report on this, and then let's see what happens.
Fool the whole world.
So if it was a social experiment, it was a really good one that we all fell into the trap.
But then that begs the question then, how do you train or how do you educate the society to be able to discern between disinformation and misinformation?
There's the issue that I want to get stuck into. So like, because it's actually quite complicated. It's quite nuanced. It depends how you're looking at it. And there's the doers and there's the consumers and there's the tech in between and there's moderation, regulation, and there's all those kinds of different issues. The way I think about it, and it's easy for me to think about it this way simply because, you know, I kind of know what I'm consuming. I'm aware of what I'm, you know, I come from a media background. I kind of know my brands and I know I know how to assess what I'm consuming, put it that way. And that just comes with a little bit of experience, but also it's just my background. I come from like I'm educated. I, you know, came up with the internet. So, you know, I kind of know how to like play the field a little bit. That probably doesn't apply to most people. I mean, the kind of people that we're talking about, a very small percentage of the world's population that kind of maybe thinks the way those of us in this room might think in terms of how we consume media. So the opportunities for really taking people down a rabbit hole of just misinformation, disinformation, it's wide open. And of course it's been abused. We know it's been abused, and the people use the platforms that we all use daily to do so. Which leads to my issue of Zuckerberg and Meta about a month ago, I don't know when it was, early January, he made an announcement that, you know, Facebook was going to step away from moderating comments, and they were going to, or rather, they're monitoring posts for validity and right and wrong, and you know, there's, again, it's a complicated issue in terms of what they're actually assessing, but he basically said, you know, we're going to leave it to the public to actually and open up the comment system in order to like assess the right and wrong, and so they can have it out on the platform. So in other words, he's saying it's not my responsibility to be the arbiter of right and wrong. And there's obviously different debates on that issue. I have not articulated very clearly and well, but maybe just get into it a little bit and just say how do you understand the issue, and maybe
X also take it from there. Moderate comments, does it?
They both have a community note system.
A community what?
It's called community notes.
Okay.
And essentially what the system does is that it democratizes content moderation.
Okay.
So if there's a post that has false information on it, somebody flags this and requests a community notes.
Okay.
There's different people, so you could sign up to community notes, so could I, so could 100 other people.
You sign up to community notes?
You can sign up to contribute towards community notes.
Okay. What is the verification process for that?
All you need to do is just have a verified phone number and your email address needs to be working.
Okay.
So you just need to have a verified
cell number, email address. Like you would just when you open any of the social accounts. Okay.
And then you could apply to be a contributor towards community notes. And what happens is that, say there's a misleading post or a post that has disinformation, somebody could correct that post, and then a group of people vote on whether that correction is... suitable for that.
Okay.
So
Wikipedia model.
Yeah. So it's this democratization of, of
moderating
of fact. Right. And this is where I think it's problematic, is because I think that I can understand the argument from the perspective of people come from different backgrounds.
Right.
We have a different context. So if something is potentially moderated or fact-checked in a certain way, it may miss out, say, for example, some cultural nuances.
Right.
But I think it's dangerous in the sense of we're disputing facts, because your facts matter and my facts matter. It's like what you think is your facts. They have a place to exist, and then what I think is my facts, they have a place to exist.
Perhaps in context.
No, but sometimes they're so completely different from each other.
Right.
And this is why I think fact and information in this information ecosystem that we're in, and protecting the integrity of an information ecosystem, is so critical right now. Because I have no background in science at all, nothing. And say, for example, there's a post about something, you know, something in space.
Right, meteorites.
Yeah, whatever it is, right? And somebody requests a community note, and then there's one person who goes, who does potentially have this information and this knowledge and expertise, and goes and provides a note, but we don't really know. So I don't know. It's like, should I be voting on this? Because I actually don't know how to verify this. And this is why I think fact-checking is so important, because what fact-checkers do is that fact-checkers aren't the arbiters of truth.
Right.
They don't say this is right and this is wrong in that particular way. They go and they engage with experts. They go and they try and find the people who have the knowledge and expertise on an issue. And then they come back and say, we've fact-checked this, and we've spoken to, you know, if it's something to do with the economy, we've spoken to these economists, and this is the view. And, you know, it may be, this post may be a bit misleading, or, you know, that we can't get to a complete truth on this because maybe that complete truth doesn't exist. I think that's why fact-checking is important. So you could have a community notes model, but I think replacing fact-checking and content moderation in its entirety is an exceptionally dangerous thing to do right now. And just to sort of bring it back to South Africa at the moment is all of these issues that's happening around land expropriation, right? And it's a really tough one to get into. I mean, I'm with you in terms of, you know, we have the skills to get in, like to be able to moderate content ourselves and see what's right from wrong and not get pulled into things. But these algorithms are so designed to capture you into an echo chamber that I was really in, you know, very much part of the outrage machine for the last 2 weeks. And it's so bad for your health, because you're just like, what world are we living in right now?
Were you packing your bags?
No, absolutely not. I mean, but the opposite was happening.
Right.
You know, I was getting triggered in the opposite way, where it's just like, well, how are we living in the society where there's just a complete disregard for our history and what's happened? And that, you know, in the context of real wars and, dare I say, genocides that are happening,
right,
to claim that, you know, there's an actual genocide in South Africa. And this is and then it's not just sort of conversations that happen in small little pockets. I mean, it's reaching powerful people in the world that's going, and it's having, you know, potential, it will have potential economic impacts and sanctions. And it's really frustrating. And do you know what? I've sort of been doing this research around this, is that none of these inflammatory posts about South Africa and our Land Expropriation Act got any community notes.
Oh.
There was no community notes on what Musk was saying, on what Trump has been saying, on what Alex Jones and all of these other conspiracy theorists. No community notes have been applied to these posts. And
sorry,
this is,
which platforms have community notes?
So X has it, and then Meta has now also introduced the system of community
notes. So far it's Meta and X.
Yes.
Okay.
And this is, it goes beyond just the sort of the dangers of, you know, providing context. Because obviously, I would say that constitutional law experts in South Africa should be the ones to provide context to these posts.
Yeah.
Not somebody who hasn't been, you know, who doesn't know the law, who hasn't been studying these issues, who doesn't have any context of what South Africa, our past and so on, to be able to say, well, actually, what Trump and Musk is saying is true. But I think the bigger issue that it lends itself to is that it seems that X in particular, and I'm not sure where Meta will be on this, but X in particular is going to be used to drive, you know, a particular ideological viewpoint that Musk subscribes to,
right,
as well as to promote Trump administration policies.
Right.
And can you expect that platform then to be able to moderate in a way where, if they are spreading disinformation, they're going to, that their own system that they've created will be used to try to balance the playing field?
Right.
I don't think so. And I think this is why it's, you know, X in particular, I find, is quite a very dangerous platform for disinformation.
Yeah.
Is
it because of the
freedom of speech? It's a very dangerous platform for your mental health. Like, it's not, It's not something you should be on, because when the algorithm gets you into, and I don't know if this is just a me experience, but right. I found that I was getting so addicted to the fights. I would actively look for
the fights.
For the fights and the trolling. And, you know, what's it's going on. Because
though.
It is. Because instead of watching like wrestling or MMA or boxing, right. here you have people like just going at each other, just, you know, over the most random things. And this is what makes that platform so powerful. Because I've tried Blue Sky and I've tried Threads and it's boring.
Right.
It's boring. Yeah, because there's nothing, like nobody's fighting with each other. And when I started to realize that this is what was happening in my brain,
right.
that I was looking for this for entertainment purposes, I was like, oh, this is dangerous.
It's toxic stuff. I need to see people fight to get entertained.
Precisely, you know? I mean, and you just sort of, you start your day doom scrolling and right. it has an impact on your mental health because you sort of think that everything that you see on your algorithm is real. Mm. So, yeah.
That's crazy.
So, look, I, from my perspective, because I think about it a fair amount, and it's not that, I haven't come to a solution. It's more like, I'm not sure if a solution is possible. Mm. Like, I'm not sure if you can get a platform that technically the world's population can use. Like, you want the whole world on one platform, for example.
Mm.
Facebook is pretty much on its way. Mm. And the number of different views there, the number of contexts, the number of cultures, the number of just different perspectives on the platform means, yes, underneath all of that, there may be a fact that is indisputable. Mm. The problem with that is it's almost like even if you get a fact checkers, you almost need a fact checkers the size of the world's population to actually make that even work. And so idealistically, I think most people would be on board with it, be like, yeah, of course we need proper fact checkers, particularly around election discourse or something like that. Mm. But how does that, and I'm a practical person in this regard, like I need to understand how that works technically.
Mm.
And also, you know, your perspective in terms of free speech. And of course there's around the world, there's certain things that are not included in free speech, like, you know, hate speech, bullying, those kind of things there's not free speech or spreading, you know, blatant lies, posting lies, it's not free speech, you know.
Yeah.
There's certain tools that can flag that, like from the machine, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, and this is where I'm somewhat sympathetic to Zuckerberg a little bit, not completely, just because I think that the task was just so monumental that it's like, we can't solve this problem. This is kind of out of our control. And it's like, and that raises other interesting issues, like, okay, fine, if you're responsible for this particular platform and you're allowing these things to, and you're profiting off this this interaction, these individuals interacting, of course there's a degree of responsibility there.
Yeah.
And that's one side of the argument. And the other side for me would be, okay, it's almost impossible to regulate. And taking COVID as a pretty good example, like there's a general assumption that governments or health institutions are somewhat the right. And that was proven to not be the case, in particularly in the States and around COVID. So that creates other problems in this for a platform like Facebook, who did initially try and regulate this communication, but they were getting calls to take down information they knew to be true from government organizations. So it creates like this weird cesspool of just nonsense where you just actually can't.
Yeah,
you can't solve the problem. So, I don't know. Like, what are your views on that? Because it's for me, it's almost like insurmountable. But I'm hoping I'm wrong.
I think that there was a sort of what they've done with community notes. I find to be just a bit too extreme.
Okay.
So I think that there could have been a few other things that they could have done before just getting to the point of reducing all, just removing fact checkers and that type of content moderation and just relying purely on a community node system.
Right.
And that's one part of that is because sort of studies have found that community nodes is quite a flawed system. Again, because what I was saying about not everybody will have the expertise to be able to provide context. So if you may be voting on something to be added to a note just because it feels right, but you have no actual expertise on this. But two is that just in there are sort of biases in the way that community notes itself can be applied to an issue. So you'd find perhaps that in more Western aligned issues, you'd have a community notes, but then in like localized domestic issues, you may not have, right. You may not even have enough people who would have signed up to provide community notes to then be able to provide context in your local,
right.
In relation to your local stuff. But I think that, you know, it's similar to Oppenheimer when he created the nuclear bomb, very aware of what this could do and the sort of the destruction of this. And the way in which the bomb could be used and how many millions of people could die. And I think that in the same way that these platforms are pretty dangerous,
yeah.
if there are no controls. And I do think you need to have controls. And I think that as we are sort of, every society is a rules and laws-based society, right? And there is, I completely understand this thing of creating a borderless digital state.
Right.
Where you have different people and different rules apply. And the cultural context is different. But I don't think just leaving it to figure itself out,
yeah.
is the solution to this. And, you know, we saw the real world dangers in, for example, in Myanmar, where there was so much of hatred and disinformation spread about the Rohingya people that led to violence against them and then the eventual displacement. And part of that problem was just there was nobody there who understood the language. So nobody in Facebook was actually there to understand the language of monitoring these posts to see what was going down in order to flag it,
right.
in order to sort of shut certain things down. And that spiraled. And I think that, you know, those are the real world harms. It's not just something of you getting caught into a rabbit hole and then you're staying there. It sort of actually impacts your day-to-day behaviors, how you view people, how you engage with people. So I think, you know, I can understand the difficulty of what Zuckerberg is saying. But I think you have a responsibility to figure it out.
I think he can.
But even the sort of content moderation, I mean, part of like a few Facebook whistleblowers were saying that a large part of the, you know, content moderation, like if you're flagging something,
right.
it goes through AI.
Right.
Right. So it's an automated response.
Right.
And it is only like a sort of very small percentage. And this is not just Facebook. I think there's for a ton of other social media companies, it's the same. Only a small percentage of it gets, you know, human oversight.
Almost by necessity, though.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know, because can machines, can AI understand particular context? Can it understand power dynamics? Can it understand, you know, and it goes to...
I would suggest it's the only solution that's going to emerge out of this, just given the volume.
Yeah.
And then there's different, obviously there's different arguments behind that in terms of who trains the AI. But,
yeah.
Yes. But just in terms of volume and speed and required resources to crunch this problem, which to me it's just this massive problem.
Look, I don't think it's a one-sided solution. I'm not saying just employ AI and get a solution for content moderation. Yes, maybe it's a hybrid. From at a particular level, there's AI at work, and then you have your human beings come in at bringing in those comments, but you can't just leave it and go, the problem is too big to solve without even trying. Try and be transparent.
Yeah.
Right? Try and go, look, I'll use AI to this point.
Yeah.
And this is the truth, or this is the picture that AI can paint for you.
Yeah.
As far as the truth is concerned. Yeah. Right. And I'll rely on human beings to come and assist this AI in completing the image.
Yeah.
But to go, no, this is outside my control. With all the capabilities you have of developing
I mean, there's also a profit question that comes into mind, because it's really expensive to develop this type of technology. It's really expensive to employ the machines. It's really expensive to go through, you know, every time there's a dispute, potentially there's an arbitration process, whatever it may be.
Right.
And I do think that these companies and platforms generally put their profit over public safety.
True.
And they're not investing in this. I mean, there's another very big platform who I understand has one content moderator for the entire continent of Africa. It's one person, right?
Wow.
I mean, they're also using automation in AI.
Right.
But there's one person.
Are they transparent about what they're using the AI for? Well,
I mean, I would hate to be that person and have that job to just
55
sort of like
countries.
Go Come through. On, but I mean, but can one person, I mean, do you speak all of the languages? Do you understand right. all of the
cultural
context?
You can't.
So the social media companies in particular have been so opaque about content moderation. They've been so opaque about how many actual human beings they have. You know, during the elections last year, there was a few opportunities where I had to engage with some of these platforms to find out what they're doing to prevent disinformation in relation to South Africa's election. And I just sort of kept asking, well, how many content moderators do you have in South Africa? And they can't give you an answer because they don't have a particular person sitting in or people, group of people sitting in South Africa to say we're actively monitoring this. Large parts of it are automated, and then
but
if
it
can
be a cost-related issue, though.
Well,
they're making more than enough money.
No, I think that it is a cost-related issue, and it's
what,
because
to employ 100 people.
Well, I don't think they want to. I don't think they want to. That's the thing, is that they've set up their businesses for profit.
Right.
They never when this is why I think it's like when Zuckerberg and all of these guys started their social media platforms, they weren't thinking about safety. They were thinking about how do we connect the world? How do we connect people to each other? And we are trusting that people will keep themselves safe because you're reasonable people and so on. But then
a person is reasonable, a mob is not.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah.
But then what the algorithms did was it created mobs.
The mob.
It put us all into different mobs. And when they created the algorithm, the content recommendation algorithm, again, it wasn't out of malice. It wasn't to
serving you what you
like. It was just like, okay, well, how can we make this platform, you know, cool?
Right.
And what could bring people back? And let's just feed them information that they like. But then when people like the dangerous information or sort of the conspiracy theories or things that are like going to pull you into spaces that appeal to your biases and your fears, what happens then? So
from your perspective, what's your ideal? Like, how would you like to see this pan out over the next 5 years? Because I'm pretty good at like exploring issues from different perspectives. So like I'm not really like, oh, this is the way I think and blah blah blah. This is my viewpoint. I like to explore like, you know, perspectives. Mm. But every time I do that and I explore in different perspectives of what could be a possible solution to this, it always gets to the point of like, that's not going to work, or this is not going to work. Whichever way you go down, it's kind of like you get to this dead end. Like, even if the governments came out and found some way to regulate Facebook and force them to invest in this issue, there's obviously still going to be loopholes. But at some point, Zuckerberg could just say, you know, this is a headache. Fuck this. I'm shutting down.
Yeah.
Like, whatever. It's not worth it for me to do that. So, and then I would argue that the world is probably worse off not having such a platform. But that's debatable.
Yeah.
But what's your idea? What would you like to see? Yeah. Put it that way.
I mean, I think it's something we have to be pragmatic about these issues because there's no silver bullet.
Yeah.
So there's no one thing that's going to solve the problems that we're experiencing online. I think a first step would be, and I know this sort of ticks a lot of people off, but I would say a first step would be regulation.
Okay.
Of these platforms, but you're still protecting free speech.
Right.
So there's limitations, as you spoke about. There's limitations to free speech, which is your hate speech and, you know, disinformation and so on. But you don't want to create laws that, in say, for example, an authoritarian state will then be used against activists or journalists for calling out the government. So those are the sort of tricky nuances that you have to work through. But, for example, the European Union introduced the Digital Services Act, and it's a comprehensive piece of legislation. But what it does is that it puts in basic rules around disclosure, around transparency, around accountability for safety purposes. So it's not saying this is how you should and shouldn't moderate your content, and this is truth and this is lies. It's saying you need to make sure that you're sort of holding billions of people in your platform, that your platform is safe, It's not going to lead towards extremism, violence in any way, that your algorithms, you know, where your algorithms are sort of, you know, pushing content that is really sensationalist or really inflammatory, that you're taking proactive measures to sort of try to address that. So it's, again, there's still loopholes around that, because that, you know, with the DSA, these platforms are finding ways to work around it. But what it does is that it just provides a cover to the residents of the European Union, so that if you are experiencing any type of, you know, sort of digital abuse online, you at least have a bit of legislation that can be used and tested to see whether and see how comprehensive it is. We don't have that.
Can Africa actually afford it?
I think we're going to have to.
South Africa regulates, the neighboring countries don't. But
it is the type of thing where maybe it is, you know, this is where the African Union should be coming in, around continent-wide regulation, where that if there are times, so like, for example, what you saw in Ethiopia, in Tigray, of how Facebook was also used there in terms of promoting violence and so on, you know, there should be a place where you could take these issues and Facebook is held accountable for that. But there's nothing you can do about it, even though the platform was being used to incite violence. So it's not the people is one thing. Yes, you can throw the people in jail. But what about the platform that keeps holding this information, that keeps spreading this information, that doesn't actually find ways to fact check the information or try to find ways to sort of simmer down? And I understand the risks with that, because I also don't want some corporate company trying to simmer down, you know, real issues that are like real struggles that are happening in my space. Like, I want to be able to talk about this and organize around it. But there's, you can't just sort of do this and incite crazy amounts of violence and get away with it. Mm-hmm. There has to be accountability. So I think if you have some types of regulations that just provide, because, you know, essentially when we use their platforms, we're in their world.
Right.
We have to play by their rules. It's their systems. But what happens when that thinking and that behavior moves from their world into the real world? And now there's no rules. Yeah. There's no systems to try to manage this and contain this. What do we do? So I think that would be a step one. Mm. But I think that, you know, responsible tech platforms, and I do think that there's such a thing. I don't feel like I'm so naive and romantic. I do think that there could be such a thing as responsible tech platforms.
Sustainable, scalable, profitable.
Profitable. Would be able to find ways to, where you're not being driven into these outrage machines.
Okay.
You're able to engage with information and diversity of perspectives and views. And you're able to, where there's been a flagrant abuse of sorts, there's an accountability mechanism of sorts, and that there are, you know, experts who would be able to provide context or information on issues that not all of us are.
No, absolutely. I just think, you know, like, it's almost like there's a suggestion, like, you don't want people to be people, you know? At the end of the day, like, there's just, people are nasty. And they have nasty they say nasty things, they try and do nasty things, and there's nasty ideas, and there's people with not even like vested interests. It's just like they'll say stupid things, and they'll just stir the pot and play it off as fact. And it's almost impossible to. So regulation absolutely needs to. There's a road there that needs to be gone down.
Right.
Where it ends up and how it ends up in the next decade or so. It's like.
We'll see.
It's almost like, for me, I see it as a workflow. It's like, okay, there's a big platform everyone's using. There's certain flags that are obvious, like bullying, hate speech, and so on, that get flagged and tagged, and it kind of goes, in an ideal world, perhaps that gets funneled into a government agency to get dealt with, like a law enforcement agency and so forth. Those are complicated systems. But again, it's like we have to try.
Regulation would be the responsibility of governments, right? Then what is the responsibility of citizens in this case?
Well, that's the thing, is that building digital literacy and building this type of resilience and being able to understand, you know, your own information consumption habits. Because, again, even with me, somebody who works on this stuff every day, I I can still be pulled into something because it appeals to a bias that I don't even know that I have, you know, but it's triggering something in me.
Yeah, but how do we constantly check ourselves as consumers of those platforms?
Well, that's the thing is that there was a time when I was just sort of the only information that I would consume would be left-leaning things. So I would read The Guardian and I would read like Watch Democracy Now and listen to those podcasts, follow those particular activists and people. And that was all where I was.
Right.
And you cannot live in that bubble because if you live in that bubble, you have a very narrow and naive view of the world. And I had to actively start, and it's painful.
Mm.
It's really painful. But I've had to actively start to engage with information and ideas that I still don't believe in.
Right.
But I have to engage with it because I have to understand something bigger than what's in my bubble.
Well, all I can say is very well done for that, because most people do not take that step.
Yeah.
And I think any sort of bubble is just as toxic as the next. It's not like you go into a bubble, it's toxic. It just ends up being nasty.
Yeah. And it's also it's difficult in this time where you often feel like you have to pick a side. You have to choose a side.
Right.
You know, there's no gray area. So it's either right to left or, you know, up or down, or you can't.
The most outrageous reaction is the one that gets the most hits.
Precisely. And, you know, it's sort of even like engaging with some like friends or comrades of mine, they'd be this, well, why are you even listening to these people? Why are you even going down this rabbit hole? And it's not so much to go down a rabbit hole, but it's also important to just understand how different people are viewing this issue.
Right.
And I try to not go to the conspiracy theorists. So I try to,
they're entertaining.
No, they are entertaining, but I mean, I try to sort of still stay within reasonable grounds. I'm not going to go to like extremes,
right?
You know, that are going to try to pull you to either side. I'm going to try and find information that keeps you within reasonable.
This is why I don't get growth on my social media, because I'm far too measured. I'm far too like, I do take in different perspectives, and it's like it just
follow Scott on social media.
It doesn't work for people.
Yeah. There's no clout. Yeah, there's like, what I want.
Meanwhile, that's exactly how you should be as a person.
Precisely.
in my view.
No, but 100%. Yeah. I mean, I have a friend who often takes this, and I hate it.
Yeah.
He often takes this, well, you know, I don't really know too much about that issue, so I'm not really going to engage with that. So I'm just going to like figure it out on my own. And he refuses to be pulled into things. And it's so frustrating. But I think spending enough time with him, it was just like, well, actually, that's how we all should be.
Right.
You know, we should all, because we don't, again, we aren't experts in everything. And you need to be spending the time to understand, to try and figure out what's going on, for you to come to your own decision without being pulled by the algorithm or the loudest voice into taking a particular perspective. And it's hard. It's hard in this world where we're so polarized, and you have to choose a side.
I think we lived in an interesting time. Like, my general feelings would be that social media is not necessarily it's not going to be in the same place it is. It's not going to continue like this. I think we're starting to see people just not bothering. Because it became such this crazy wild west of ideology and I think we're already starting to see people pulling back. The kids there don't engage with it as much as they used to. And it is, but I'm kind of happy I lived through it. I thought it was fascinating. It was just wild time.
Yeah. I mean, I was sort of, when I was in university and studying journalism, I remember sitting in, I think it was probably my third year, and sitting in class and watching the entire Marikana massacre play out on Twitter, you know, and it was this, there was this sort of thing of, at that time, journalism wasn't really thinking about social media and how social media was going to be this massive place where we're going to get and like consume our news and you know, spread, engage and so on. And I think it was in a class around broadcast journalism and how essential it is for the world and so on. And it was this weird thing because I was just watching this play out in real time.
In real time.
And I thought it was fascinating. And then when I sort of started my job, it was very much about, I was, you know, I really drank that Kool-Aid about how social media is going to just make the world a better place, because now we can organize and now we can you know, sort of we can engage on issues. And the Arab Spring was
everyone
also
will be heard.
Precisely, but it was it did
flatten the world, though, right?
You know,
suddenly you could see
100%. And also, I mean, in my third year, I mean, the Arab Spring was happening in that year in social, right. Social media, Twitter in particular, was this huge space for young people to organize. That was powerful,
right.
You know, and I guess maybe it is just from where I was from a political perspective. I was like, this is going to be fantastic. We are going to change the world. And now you sort of look back and you look back, I mean, with naivety, because I genuinely think that at the time that was the intention. I think people were really excited about these tools because they knew how it could be used to give those who didn't have a voice a platform. I mean, so many people who've been shut out of our economies now are participating in a digital economy.
Yeah.
I may not agree with their grift and their hustle. But all of a sudden, you know, people are able to sort of generate an income from doing the influencing or whatever it may be. And so there is power in this. There is potential in this. It's just, how do you make sure that we are building safe technology?
Mm.
So, for example, when you're driving a car, you want your car to be safe.
Right.
You know, you want to make sure your seatbelts work, your airbags, the whole thing. You could still crash, but you want to know when you're getting into that car that that car potentially is safe.
Right.
It feels every day we're just in a car crash, multiple car crashes on social media every day. And there's no, there's just sort of the scariness about young people in particular, the sort of the impact that it has on mental health about, I mean, I'm still somebody who gets pretty insecure if I'm on Instagram, you know, if, you know, looking at certain people who look a certain type of way and like, oh, my body doesn't look like that and I'm not. And then in the same time, so you're looking at all of these, you know, models, whatever, and they look like in a particular type of way, and then you get hit with the gym memberships right after that. And then right after that, there's like another advert for a diet, you know, and then right after that, there's another ad, like another ad for, you know, just your mental health. And the reason why you're not able to stick to things is because you have ADHD. So the algorithm is like,
you know, it's in your head,
making me think that I have a mental health issue. And I'm somebody who engages with this stuff and I understand where it's coming from and the profit models of it. But there's so many people who don't get the algorithms and they don't understand why they're seeing what they're seeing. And it can take you into really bad places. So these days, I just chill on Pinterest because it's so lovely. There's nobody fights. It's
nothing.
Just lovely. Like, it's just really lovely content. So that's my solution, is that if I want to scroll, I go to Pinterest.
Just go to Pinterest and doom scroll.
Yeah. It's probably a good place to close. There's another issue that I did want to discuss, but it's quite nuanced, and we shouldn't really get into it now anyway. Is the rise of influencer journalists in the sense of, there's always been personality journalists, but they've always been kind of held under a brand of some sort, that because the means of distribution or the means of their voice was held within a particular network or platform or newspaper or something like that. That's not necessary anymore. So we're seeing quite a few guys, and Substack is blowing up. Substack's an amazing platform. There's really good writers and journalists on that platform that are earning a living independently, and they're riding on their reputation for now. But it opens up the sense of they've got their followers and they've got their credibility, but it also opens up really, again, just this sense of
dangerous,
easy to just be so polarized and just go down your own rabbit hole and your own fame. Like, you're not accountable to anyone.
Yeah.
You're accountable to just earning some money, getting $5 subscription or whatever it is, and you just...
Yeah.
So again, I think that's kind of like the new, almost like the next frontier of like, oh, it's credible journalists, but but no one's holding them account. They're not members of any sort of, they don't have some boss that's going to, you know, they don't have some fact checkers on them.
Can I just on that? I know it potentially takes us down somewhere different, but I think I really just, and this is not coming from a place of having studied journalism, but I really just detest this idea that everybody can be a journalist. And, you know, it comes from like Musk's thing of, well, you're the media now,
right?
You know, and it's sort of an encouragement that just because you have a platform and you have a, you know, a voice, so you can shape the world and the information as you see it.
Yeah.
And there's an art to journalism that I think most people don't understand. They just think you're reporting on whatever. But there's a real discipline to it in terms of how do you understand information? How do you engage diverse perspectives? How do you allow for a right of reply? You know, how do you present a story in a way that is going to get, you know, sort of meaning? That there's going to be, you're helping the public to understand the world and frame the world. Right. I mean, the profession obviously has been abused and weaponized, and I recognize that, and I recognize why there's such distrust in the media. But these days, there's nothing that just grinds me more than seeing the sort of influencers who get, you know, they have these really nice little podcasts and they, you know, well, I don't, no offense, but they have these really nice little podcasts and they interview like these bigwigs, political bigwigs and others. And they ask, they do nothing in terms of trying to shape the conversation or like get the truth. And it's because they're not trained in this way. But they have some of the biggest platforms in terms of reach and viewership and engagement, and young people in particular who are engaging in politics by following these sort of influencer types. And I think that it works in the favors of politicians because they know that they'll go onto these platforms and get really easy interviews where they can just, you know, shape things the way that they want and there's going to be no pushback. So the sort of politicians and the bigwigs would rather go into those spaces as opposed to going onto a real news channel and being sort of interviewed by a hardcore journalist that is going to push back and does know the facts and, you know, will be able to hold you accountable. And so even with that, I think I think that we do have to go into a space where, and I don't want to be that person because I know I'm like, oh, we need rules. I think we do. Because if you're sort of broadcasting in particular ways, like, you know, with journalism in particular, there's there's self-regulation, which is important. But I do think that we are going to have to think of some sort of code that would even apply to these guys. But I get they won't do it because it then takes away from their grift. Right. This is how they build their brands.
But what is the concern there? Do you see a lot of misinformation and disinformation, or are they just not asking hard-hitting journalistic questions?
No, but it's just misleading. Okay. You know, because you, in the absence of, when you just allow people to, and especially people in power.
Right.
Who you should be demanding levels of accountability of. When you just allow them to take control of that information ecosystem without any boundaries of pushback, and you get to shape the narrative in any way that you choose to, I think that's problematic.
Okay.
Yeah, journalism is in a tough space. Let's put it that way.
But this is why we need journalism, especially at this time.
Right.
And how we build credibility in the media and journalism, I have no idea how we do this because the information landscape has changed.
We have to address leadership in journalism institutions first, which is a different ballgame.
What advice would you give to digital creators out there in this day and time? What to watch out for, how to create digital platforms, what to be considerate of when we're creating these digital platforms? I call you the referee of tech entrepreneurs, myself included. I've been refereed quite a number of times, I must say. So what advice do you have?
I think, you know, what I like about the digital creators is that they've embraced creativity.
Yeah.
And they're finding new ways to get stories out, new ways to engage the public on different types of issues, on building their own brands and so on. And I can respect that.
Right.
But I think that there's a level of responsibility that comes with that, of building influence. And this is definitely going to fall on deaf ears, because especially where you're putting the ability to gain traction and build your influence and make profit, a lot of people won't want to go down this line. But I would always just appeal to people to do things responsibly and do things ethically. You know, you find a lot of influencers who will sell you like just really dangerous products online because they're being sponsored to do so. And you can understand their hustle. But there's also a line that I think one needs to draw about to what extent are you willing to make your buck. And I know for everybody it's different. And I can sort of say this from my position in society, and for other people, their lives look different. So, you know, it's not coming from a place of judgment, but it's also just understanding the sort of the influence you have comes with a lot of responsibility,
right?
And leading people down into dangerous paths. You know, it's you have to be so mindful of this.
Yeah.
So I would say more, not so much to the digital creators, because I think that's their grift and that's their hustle, and you got to respect that to an extent. I think it's more for the users of these platforms that are being pulled into by the influencers.
Mm.
It's for them to understand what's behind all of the glitz and glam and what's behind, you know, the sort of major production or whatever it is. And for them to understand that social media is not always real life.
Yeah.
And that you have to just be so mindful about the information you consume, how you're allowing this to sort of impact the way you think and how you behave. And I think it's more on us as users. I think we have a greater responsibility to just be mindful of the types of things you're being hit with every day. I mean, it's similar, like when we were growing up, you would get, you know, you'd see all of the adverts for the sugary things, and your parents knew that that was wrong. And to some point, you also knew just consuming that much of sugar wasn't okay.
Yeah.
But it was like within moderation. Now you're just being hit with sugar ads every day, all the time. And you need to know what is good for me and my mental health and, you know, me as a person, and not be pulled into some of the stuff.
So it's a function of time then, because, I mean, social media is relatively new. People are jumping on it. Still hard to learn and understand how algorithms work. Still hard to discern whether this person really lives this kind of lifestyle or not.
Yeah.
So are you saying maybe in the next couple of years, like we did growing up seeing ads on TV, it will be, now we can tell that, no, this is a rubbish ad.
Yeah.
Are you saying with time, kids may be able to go, okay, pretender, this guy doesn't really do this stuff?
I think so. I think we may be able to build up our own resilience. But we have to be, you know, if you're intentional about this, if you're just going onto platforms, just, you know, blindly consuming information, you're going to get drawn into things. But if you're aware that you could be influenced and you're aware of how, like, your own fears or your own biases are the own things that, you know, may trigger you, you then start to look at that content very differently. Like, I look at sort of beauty and weight loss content very differently now that I know how it triggered certain sort of insecurities of me. So now I take it with a pinch of salt, you know, or even like certain political content, you know, it would still like make me want to fight, but I also just know how to take a breath and take a step back out of it and be like, okay, you know, this person is actually just probably some kid sitting somewhere just trying to drive influence.
Right.
Why are you engaging?
Yeah.
You know, just like, don't feed the outrage machine. But if there's an awareness, it becomes much more easier. If you're just passively going through it, I think it's quite hard.
So for some of us who create these digital platforms, what should we be aware of? What should our thinking be when we create these digital platforms, the mobile apps and so on? What government regulations or laws should we be thinking about when we build apps?
And we are open for sponsorship.
yes, please.
I mean, I think first and foremost is you just sort of look at the Constitution. And as long as you're, you know, sort of thinking of our Constitution in terms of our Bill of Rights and what it means about, you know, the type of society that we envision as South Africa, I mean, that's an important, the main law to consider, and that you're building technology that's not going to be infringing on anybody's rights in any way. But I think that there's that responsibility of, unlike Zuckerberg and co, who had the opportunity to not know the dangers that could come with their platforms, I don't think tech developers these days can argue they didn't anticipate that. Because we just have so much of experience right now. So that you won't be able to mitigate every single thing.
Of course.
But I think always bearing in mind how your platform could be abused, the types of dangers that could come with, you know, developing something like this, and not trying to sort of just create something that, you know, it's so tight that you can't actually navigate through it, but just being aware of this and mindful, and then being iterative in your design. So where you are seeing something that you didn't anticipate as an abuse or a danger, that you're sort of being, you're acknowledging that this actually didn't go how we anticipated, and we're going to now try to design so that we're not experiencing those types of abuses or those types of changes. And I think in that sense, it's just, I want to consume technology made by good humans who want to also do right in the world, and who are, and I can respect your, like, you wanting to make profit. That's not the issue. So I'm not, you know, so that's not the problem. I'm just wanting to be in a space where I know it's not going to be dangerous to me and to other people who are using that. And I think that credibility is likely to get more and more people on the side of tech developers who are mindful of our world, of the dangers that presently exist, and are trying to create good technology that's, you know,
so you're saying we should change the way we look at problem solving, because generally we just go, here's a problem, okay, I can try find a solution for it. Sharp problem, solution, and here's the potential market for it. Okay, then affordabilities, costs, that's about how we go about solving the problem. We don't necessarily go the step further to go, okay, how do we protect? What laws are we going up against? Is this infringing on people? We look at problem, solution, market. So are you saying that logic has to be rejected in the sense that somewhere in there we should factor in the laws and governance and make sure that people's rights are protected? I mean, the only thing we think about, honestly, is the poppy. Outside of the poppy, nothing else.
Yeah. Yes, that's what I'm saying. To put it simply. And it does require a bit more work. It does require a bit more sort of nuanced thinking about these issues. And again, you can't develop for every possible problem.
Right.
So that's not what I'm saying. But I think just going in with the intention of trying to create ethical tech. I mean, ethical tech can still be profitable.
Just try and be a good person.
Yeah, you know? Just be good people. Just be good people and we'll be fine.
Yes.
So
I'm a good person.
We've been chatting for over an hour. So,
already?
Before I wrap it up.
All right, this has been fun.
It's actually been a great chat.
It has.
I knew it was going to be, but I enjoy this chatting about this kind of stuff, clearly.
Any parting shots?
This is really fun for me too, so I'd be happy to come back and talk 100%. About other and talk about other stuff.
Our affiliate product links will be at but thanks for your time. Thanks for coming in. That was great. Appreciate it.
This was lovely.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that has been the Angle Podcast. Please do like, subscribe, share, and follow us on all social media platforms. Thank you. Peace out.